Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. It's not such a happy new year for Apple. At the close of business yesterday, Apple has suffered its biggest single-day loss in 6 years. As for the F-word, Facebook, a BBC headline put it this way. Great news for Facebook, 2018's over. Bad news, 2019 has begun. With 2019 in mind, we welcome back to our show the friend of our show, Kara Swisher. Kara is the co-founder and editor-at-large of Recode, host of the Recode Decode podcast. Subscribe, I suggest it. And a contributing opinion editor for the New York Times. Hi, Kara.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. So what big tech stories from 2018 are just going to roll right into 2019?
I think all of them. I think Facebook for sure. I mean, they got a slight respite yesterday, but it's been for the best weeks, essentially. Because there was nothing happening. But I think probably the issues around tech regulation, and it'll be the sort of the next iteration of what's already happened this year, is what are the implications? How are they going to change? I think the largeness of all these companies is going to be brought into question probably by the Democrats more than the Republicans. And so you're going to see a lot of that. Like, what are the iterations? Now, because of this government shutdown and other things, it's not clear that these politicians have time to do anything but argue with each other. So that may give tech a respite in this area.
So what happened to Apple?
Well, I think they just they were hitting the wall in China. I mean, because there's a lot of good things going on with the Chinese economy that are problematic, and then there's the trade wars that are happening, but you know, pushed by the Trump administration. And so Apple is very exposed in China because they're doing really well in China. They're one of the few U.S. companies that has managed to get into that market in a really significant way, and it's a big part of its business. And so with the slowing of the economy, they have an expensive item that they sell there. They're obviously going to get hit. And then also I think a lot of people are looking at where the iPhone is going, where the next iteration of the iPhone. And if the whole mobile thing, and it's not just Apple, if the entire mobile revolution is sort of played out and they're waiting for the next big innovation, which I wrote about this week in the New York Times, you know, Apple remains very innovative. You know, I mean, even if the AirPods, for example, are amazing. The watch stuff is, they've been really pushing forward, and the voice stuff and AR. But I'm talking about the next big thing is going to be a big question for all of tech and not just Apple.
Yeah, you wrote this great piece and how Facebook and Apple are both sort of falling short on the innovation front. Why is that, and who should we be looking to and towards? Who's being innovative?
I don't think all of them are falling short. Like, some stuff that Amazon is doing is very innovative. Some stuff that Apple's doing is innovative. It's just there's not a big secular trend. Mobile was a major trend. Like, as I wrote, you wouldn't have, like, Uber without the mobile revolution. And by the way, the iPhone was the one that really pushed forward the mobile revolution significantly by being app-centric, feature-heavy, photo-heavy. You wouldn't have Instagram without the iPhone, right? Mm-hmm. You can think about all kinds of things. And so some big revolutions, there's a big secular idea like mobile, and then there's a device that comes through like the iPhone. And then after that, all kinds of things happen in its wake. And that's what happened, you know, over the last 10 years, essentially, since 2007 is when the iPhone came in. That's a 10-year thing where all these amazing companies were created. Now, what is the next big trend? Is it 5G that's going to get everybody, you know, doing all these amazing things to replace gadgets? Is it going to be VR? Probably not. Is it AR, augmented reality? Is it transportation? Is it going to be like electric cars? So what is the big innovation, and where, or the idea of that, or automation, or AI, or machine learning? And so you have to figure out which one is going to be the big thing that's going to sort of iterate all around and create all kinds of new opportunities.
I have one more business question, then we'll talk about Congress a little bit.
Sure.
One of your colleagues at the New York Times in the tech section wrote that this 2019 is going to be IPO-palooza.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they wrote that piece. Yeah, there's a lot of IPOs coming. It's a question of how good they're going to be. You know, there's Uber, there's Lyft, there's Airbnb. There's a whole bunch of companies coming out. These are sort of the old unicorns. They called them, remember, the unicorns they were called at the time because they reached billion-dollar valuations. Now they're well beyond that. And the question is, how big will they come out? There was a $120 billion valuation attached to Uber, which seems crazy given they don't make money, and some others. And so the question is, how do they come out and how well do they do? And that'll be interesting. And I think they'll all impact each other, obviously. But the three big ones would be Uber, Lyft, and Airbnb, I think, among those spaces. And there's a couple of others. There's some others.
Are there any lessons to be learned from previous blockbuster IPOs that these companies should
heed? Well, I don't know if it's going to be a blockbuster. I mean, the last big blockbuster one was Alibaba and Facebook, really, I think. And those are companies are not even close to the kind of earning potential. Facebook was making a ton of money when it went public, so was Alibaba. And so, no. I think the question is, how will they do? How will investors think about companies that are still growing? And a lot of people question whether, they can keep in business, keep losing money, so much money as they grow, and whether they can stabilize their businesses in a way that is necessary to really be a long-lasting company. Those are going to be the questions around them. I think Airbnb has a better story. They all have to have stories when they go public, and Uber and Lyft is going to have to Lyft is smaller. They're going to have to clean up their story to make it palatable to investors, and we'll see how the stock market does. Right now, the stock market's in a really volatile state because of all the things that are happening in Washington.
Thank you for the segue. I really appreciate that. We're talking to Kara Swisher, by the way, host of the Recode Decode podcast. So you said on CNBC on New Year's Eve that you thought that the tech companies would try to take the middle of the road in the next campaign cycle by funding both sides of the aisle. So what would that look like?
Which they do now, by the way. FYI, they do it now. Like Google and others give tons of money to Republicans and the Democrats, even though most of their employees give money to the Democrats, like overwhelmingly. Their base is a Democratic base, essentially. But Google and others and Facebook, give lots of money to both sides. And so does, they all do. They all do. Just that's how the game is played, obviously. But I think they just don't want to be have their head above the shrubbery right now in Washington. Nobody does, right? And again, the people in Washington are preoccupied with either these budget situations and the wall, and of course, whether or not it's good for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to dance or not. it is obviously perfect for her to dance. She had a great response today. She's such a genius on Twitter.
Well, that's actually one of my questions I had for you is this new Congress, Congress, the average age was 57 in the last Congress, and this one, they've brought it down to 47. So
there's a couple 29-year-olds in there, yeah.
Yeah, but how do you think that Twitter and Instagram will affect Congress, affect the way business is done, the way information is disseminated?
Well, let's just say she's a genius. She's like, I just tweeted now, like when she did a response to this dance video and she did another dance, she goes, wait till they find out congresswomen dance too. And she did a dance, like, and she looks adorable doing it, right? She looks fantastic. So she's very effective. She's a genius. It was a troll back at the people who attacked her. She does that all the time. She attacks back in a way that's really clever. So she is a genius use of the medium. And you can see how effective it is for her because it just makes her more popular. Now, the question is, can she take this, organization she does on Twitter and Instagram and other mediums, which she does. I'm going to use her as an example, but she's the best one at it and by far. I mean, she's close to Donald Trump in terms of being genius about using Twitter. The question is, can she translate it into real legislation or is it just a lot of noise? And she didn't win on the green climate thing. She didn't win on the pay-go thing and, tried to organize online. But Instagram is not a vote. Instagram is not a voter, right? So can you, even if you delight people with your whatever you do on social media, can you bring it into a real thing? Like, can she make a real deal, a real legislation? And I'm just using her as an example. And that's the thing I would look towards is can she translate it, right? Can she translate it beyond just a meme? And so that'll be interesting to see. But I have to say, a lot of these young, not because they're younger, they're just more adept at using the medium. What can they do with it? And how can it impact actual legislation? By the way, Charles Grassley is great on Twitter. I have all things. I don't know how old he is, but he's not young. And so it just depends. And I think, I wrote a column the week before about how Trump is using Twitter to govern, essentially. He doesn't speak to the Democrats. He tweets at them. And so there's definitely a really interesting trend going on here. And they all do. You have George Conway tweeting about, sort of trolling his own wife on and Trump on Twitter. You've got, you know, you've got all kinds of politicians going back and forth, Rubio and Gavin Newsom's on there. There's everybody's on there talking to each other. So I think it's a really, and of course it's led by Trump doing that and Ocasio really. So it's a really interesting, it's a really interesting trend of how they don't call each other on the phone or meet quietly in corridors, but they actually tweeted each other with their intentions.
It's so, interesting. Yeah, it's so interesting the way it has changed the culture of D.C.
Yeah, completely. They're just, and Twitter is a medium. They don't use any other. They don't use Facebook. They don't use Snapchat. They don't use Reddit. Twitter is where they are, and that's also where the media is, the political media, and they go on and on. And again, it's a question of real people who don't use it really care, like if it affects the voters in any way. I think it's just the chattering class chattering at each other. But it's definitely, you know, it's being used by both the left and the right, by the way. You know, there was a what's her name?
Coulter.
That horrible woman.
Ann Coulter.
Coulter, yeah. I call her that horrible woman. She was, you know, she uses it a lot about anti-immigration stuff. And so she was tweeting at Donald Trump, and it affected him. Like, he read it, and he knocked her off of Twitter. He blocked her on Twitter, and then he did what she said on Twitter, around the wall. She sort of egged him on Twitter, which was, she'd used a number of mediums, but Twitter was a very effective one for her, where she was insulting him quite a bit on the medium. So was Rush Limbaugh and others, so. Interesting.
I want to ask you about something else that's been in the news recently. Netflix removed an episode of Hasan Minhaj's show from its streaming service in Saudi Arabia because the country claimed it violated some of its laws. First of all, there's a lot of Saudi money in Silicon Valley, correct?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, I've written about that.
Yeah, has there been any pressure for Silicon Valley to...
I don't think there's Saudi money in Netflix unless they buy it on the open market, and then you can't stop people from buying stock, right? I mean, the Saudis have a lot of money, and it's washing all over the entire economic system. So, you know, like, the Saudis own a big piece of Snapchat, I think, but there's nothing Snapchat can do about that, right? They can't stop people from buying public stock.
But how much do you think the money is? Like, how much do you think of the money is making an impact on the policy within the companies?
No, I don't think that. I think that they're worried about following these laws. And by the way, guess what? Warner Brothers, you can't get. I think Kundun. I think that was a Warner Brothers movie, which was made because of Chinese in Tibet. You can't find it. Lots of media companies over the years have pulled movies and different things like that. Because of this, because of things like this, because of laws in these countries, like Google and eBay can't sell Nazi memorabilia in Germany. You have to follow the laws of the country you're operating in, you know, depending for the good and bad, essentially. And so if you want to operate a country and they have laws against it, you really do have to follow those laws. But it still is distasteful and horrible that they have to do that. But if they want to operate there, right? And one of the problems is it becomes amplified when the internet, when it's Google, when it's Netflix and others, because it has a bigger impact than just shelving a movie, you know, Warner Brothers or whoever the movie company is that shelves a movie because the Chinese government is. It happens a lot more than you think. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just not seen. And here it's so obvious what they did. And so I think, you know, the question is, these companies will do these things in order to facilitate their businesses, and they will go along with countries' laws, and in some cases, as in Germany, where they don't want any Nazi memorabilia on eBay or certain searches on Google and stuff like that, they'll go along with that. And that people might feel good about that, but at the same time, in other countries where they're trying to quash dissent, these companies will also quash dissent, just like Google going into China right now. They're not going to be able to go in there without a search engine that censors, right? And that's been a big controversy for Google.
We're talking to Kara Swisher, host of the Recode Decode podcast. So Senator Elizabeth Warren announced she's exploring a run for the presidency next year. She's the first of many to come. We know that. Do you think we need to be concerned about potential influence on the campaign from Russia in the next election cycle? You do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they've never had a candidate like Hillary Clinton to troll, right? That she's a perfect troll person to troll on the internet, unfortunately for Hillary Clinton. But yes, I think that you think that the companies like, say, especially Facebook, and Twitter are spending a lot of time figuring out how their systems are being used and misused, and so I think they are committed. I do, to give them credit, I think they are committed to stopping it. What I complain about is they never anticipated in the first place, and then secondly, they didn't do anything about it quickly enough or take it seriously enough. And so that's the big question is, can they, these systems are so big. I mean, I think people don't understand the vast amount of information that is washing over these systems. And my conclusion by the end of the year is everybody is incompetent to the task of figuring it out. Because there's so much going on, and you can't just rely on algorithms. You've got to have people. It's just a really big problem. And so they've created platforms that by their very nature are easy to manipulate, and by their very architecture are easy to manipulate. And so that's a problem. And when you build these vast digital cities, and that's what they are, and you don't have police and fire and adequate road systems, mm-hmm. you're going to get chaos, right? You're going to get the purge every day of the week. Essentially, and so that's can you change these systems or not? And it's a big. I had John Lovett on one of my podcasts yesterday, and he said there should be a big red button, and once everybody agrees, they should just shut down the service. Like they push the button, and then it shuts down because we've been too misused. And the question is, can they ever stop these services from being misused? Because it wasn't hacking that the Russians did; it was using it. Right? That's very, hacking is different, right? They didn't sneak in.
They manipulated it.
They walked in.
Yeah.
They walked in the door, the front door. They walked in the front door. And the door was open, and they were giving them tools to manipulate the system.
All right,
that's the problem.
I saved the Facebook question for last because you can suck the whole air of the room talking about Facebook for half an hour. But Facebook isn't the only perpetrator in sharing users' data. That was the big issue.
Yeah.
Alexis Madrigal over at The Atlantic called it the data industrial complex, this idea. Facebook exchanges data with other large tech companies. Do you think there is a data industrial complex? Is that a correct way to describe it?
You know, I've used the word that they're digital arms dealers, so I shouldn't talk. I mean, you know, I use the word digital arms dealers in the column at the time. You know, I think the issue is, I said they weaponize. They've been weaponizing everything from the First Amendment to data, right? Like, not just them, but everybody who's in. Look, they're, again, as with the example with Netflix and previous media companies that have censored, other companies that you never heard of have been misusing data forever, right? You're taking it in, squashing it, mushing it up, and then targeting you. It's just become amplified in this new environment. The targeting has gotten so good, and you give up so much information everywhere you go when you're carrying a cell phone. You're transmitting so much information about what you do, where you go, what you search for, where you eat, where you pay. Just if you do all these things on your phone, you're just giving up so much information. And the question is, how is it used, right? And which one of these many apps is, like, Apple is not using your data. They don't, right? They do in some ways, but not for diagnostics, but they're not an advertising business. So in some ways you're safer with them. And certain things, what is Google Maps doing with your location? What is Facebook doing with this? What are they doing with your email? You know, when you pay at Venmo, what is that? What's happening to that information? And so that's the question is, and they all mix together, and that's one of the big problems. And so I don't think it's a new problem that people are misusing data. I think it's always been a problem since the beginning of time when they can track things. I think it's just an increasing amount of data is going to be out there to be manipulated. And you see that, say, in China, like to the nth degree, where they have sensors and cameras, and it's a surveillance economy. And they have this thing called the social, you've read about this year, the social score,
mm-hmm.
Where you're scored on, like, if you jaywalk, that goes in, right? And that goes into the group of your social score. Everything you do is monitored, and therefore you get a score. Now, that was an episode of Black Mirror, by the way, just so you know. That was, like, I've decided every single thing that could happened on Black Mirror. It's going to happen on Black Mirror already. And so the question is, as you collect all this information, what can people do with it? In China, the government and even the people there are more willing to be monitored and surveilled. And the question is, are we going to get there at some point? And what should our politicians, getting back to Washington, do about this? Should there be massive privacy legislation like there has been in Europe or in California, for example? What is the role of government in monitoring this? What is the role of the citizens? What is the role of the states? And so I think those are the kind of questions that are going to be brought up this year too. Like, privacy legislation is certainly on the docket. I did a good interview with Nancy Pelosi about this, and I think as soon as she gets out of this mess, that's one of the areas they're going to look at.
Kara Swisher is the host of Recode Decode podcast, co-founder and editor-at-large at Recode, and contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. Kara, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
We'll be right back with the creator of a new jazz opera called Dear Eric, an intimate family story of tragedy and family love during World War II. More after a quick break. Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. A new jazz opera called Dear Eric uses more than 200 real wartime letters written between 1938 and 1941 from Herta Rosenthal to her son Eric. The opera libretto melodically details the love, the tragedy, and redemption that Eric faced after he escaped to Chicago from Nazi Germany while his family had to stay behind. Eric's son is Ted Rosenthal, one of the leading jazz pianists of our generation. Ted, along with his wife Leslie, wrote and co-composed Dear Eric. Let's take a listen to You Make Me Laugh, about Eric falling in love, listening to jazz, and dancing in Chicago.
Can't believe it.
Dear Eric will have its world premiere January 9th. It's playing the 10th, 12th, and 13th at the Museum of Jewish Heritage. It is co-produced by the National Yiddish Theater Volksbühne and the New York City Opera. Joining me in studio is Ted Rosenthal. Hi, Ted.
Hi, pleasure to be here.
And New York City Opera General Director Michael Capasso. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thank you.
So you guys are friends in real life, too, right?
We are. Long time.
This is not just a professional relationship. This is also a personal. We'll get to that in just a minute. Ted, how did you find these letters?
These letters were in the attic of the house I grew up in Great Neck. My father never discussed them, as is fairly typical of Holocaust survivors. Mm-hmm. These memories were quite painful, and I only knew the barest minimum about my grandparents and other family members lost in Germany. So after he passed away back in 1995, we packed up the house. There was this box of letters, and for some fluky reason, I took them. And they ended up staying in the attic of the house I currently live in, unopened, really uninvestigated, because they're in German, and I don't read German and cursive writing. But 2.5 or 3 years ago, we were invited back to my grandmother's hometown, a small town called Bad Camberg outside of Frankfurt. And for some reason, I decided to take the letters out of the box, tell the people who invited us, which was the Historical Society of Bad Camberg. The occasion for inviting us was the opening of a small Jewish school that was refurbished. And I said, you know, by the way, there are these letters. Would you guys be interested? And they said, well, this is a historical society, and she's a member of our community, was a member, and of course we're interested. So they translated about the first six. And when the translations came in, it was honestly mind-blowing. Oh, I started to get a sense of this family my father never shared. The tears were welling up, and I was feeling connected to people that I just never knew about. I was named actually after my grandfather, so I was reading letters from Theodore Rosenthal. My sister's middle name is Herta, and I was, you know, my grandmother reading her letters, of course. And it was such a warm, loving mother-son relationship. You know, while she was enduring Nazi persecution and the walls closing in, she was really protecting Eric from a lot of that. Mm-hmm. So after the first six came in, I said, you know, there are a few more letters. Would you mind?
194.
Yeah, at least. And he dutifully, we like to joke with German precision, translated them all chronologically. And these revelations began to inspire an artistic response, an outpouring that has come to fruition in the form of a jazz opera.
I have a woo-woo question, and then we'll get back to my woo-woo question. Is, you said, you kept saying, I have this box, and I kept it, and then I put it in the attic. Do you ever think that the ancestors were guiding you, that your ancestors were guiding you towards toward Ted, read the letters?
Well, you know, I think, Allison, that there's a time in life for things, and when you're younger, you're maybe even more busy, although I've never been more busy in my life preparing for this opera. But, you know, you start to get interested, I think, in your history and your family, and these things take on a certain resonance, I think, when you're older. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm that old. But so when I was younger, just sort of, I had a bit of tunnel vision. It was music, 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 jazz, jazz, jazz. And, you know, in the recent years, I've become more interested in this family connection. Mm-hmm.
So, Michael, your friend calls you with this idea and says, I think I have something here. I want to make a jazz opera. What was your first response?
Well, recently, actually, there has been opera in jazz, although there is a history with Scott Joplin and mm-hmm. Tremonisha and things like that, and, of course, Gershwin. But it was... you know, I said, well, you know, okay. And I know Ted, and I know his music very, very well. And he had actually written a short little dance piece for me many, many years ago with great success. But my big question was, can he write for the voice? So I said, look, put some things together, and we'll, you know, we'll put some singers with it, and we'll find out. And the big sigh of relief I had more than anything else was that he seems to, well, he does have an innate ability to write for the voice. He not only has a feel for the idiom, and he and it is jazz, but he also writes beautiful melodies that sit well for singers, which is something that I think, you know, they try to teach to people, but it's better if you have it naturally. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing that fascinated me the most. I mean, of course, the story is the story, and but, you know, you could, the greatest story in the world, it put to music, if it's not good music, is not going to help anybody. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that the music was so interesting, and that his ability to write for the voice was so strong, that's what led us on to, you know, the first and then the second workshop, and now ultimately this production.
Did you have that concern yourself?
Well,
about writing for the voice?
No, I would say writing for the voice felt fairly natural. I've had a chance to play with some of the greatest jazz singers, Ann Hampton Callaway, mm-hmm. Kurt Elling, Barbara Cook. So I had a sense that, you know, I write melodically and things. And again, I'm hoping people will walk out of the theater humming many of these melodies. But the drama aspect, I would say, has presented the biggest challenge and taken an amazing amount of thought mm-hmm. and refining and editing and reworking. And that's, you know, as a jazz musician or even just a musician who's been involved in a lot of different kinds of music, this dramatic element was the newest element for me.
We're speaking with writer-composer Ted Rosenthal and New York City Opera General Director Michael Capasso about Dear Eric, a jazz opera that the performances are starting on January 9th at the Museum of Jewish Heritage. So, Ted, your collaborator is your wife,
yes.
Leslie, mm-hmm. Who's also a lawyer by training, and mm-hmm. she's COO of Juilliard. So you guys get along, I'm sure. There was research involved in this, and I heard an interview with her that was quite interesting about visiting the Holocaust Museum and
yes.
what was found there. Would you share that with our listeners?
Well, this you could say, maybe people were watching over us to make this happen, because she has often, as she likes to call herself, a jazz wife, come on many trips with me all over the country and all over the world. And this was an occasion where she was teaching a mini course at George Washington University in D.C., and I just went along with her, no gigs, just hanging out. And I had some free time, and I said, you know, I've never been to this Holocaust Museum. And I called her up, and I said, if you get done with your course, they close at 6, and let's try to get in and see it. So we sort of rushed through it. But the very last room is this research room, and on a lark, I typed in Herta Rosenthal, and boom, this stuff came up, you know, her picture, information about her that we never knew. And this was part of this whole revelation between that and then the letters of reinvestigating my family history. And Leslie has also been wonderful. There's a song in the opera called The Immigration Song. And of course, these issues resonate quite strongly today. And people, even quite educated people, don't always realize that it wasn't that the Jewish people necessarily couldn't get out of Germany, it was that no one would let them in. So we have an immigration song in the opera where the immigration officer keeps raising the bar. You know, you need 4 affidavits, you need 6 affidavits, you need a higher guarantee. No, you can't come. And ultimately, they just couldn't come. And that sealed the fate of my grandparents and many others like them. So Leslie did a lot of wonderful research in that regard as well, finding out precisely what happened. And then we adapted some of those phrases to the actual libretto.
And of course, the letters themselves. You actually, you brought a letter with you. Would you mind sharing this
with us?
And will you give it context to it for our listeners?
Well, this is probably the most difficult letter. It's actually a composite of two. Mm-hmm. And every time one of the wonderful leads from City Opera, Jessica Tyler Wright, sings it in rehearsal or in workshop, it brings tears to my eyes. And these are my grandmother's words. It begins on November 14, 1938, which is a few days after Kristallnacht. And she says, "Dear Eric, your letter of November 2 arrived Friday, November 11. Meanwhile, you will have got the papers, punch dolls, and chocolate. I cannot give you much news. Your father and uncle have gone away for an undetermined period, together with many friends and relatives. That is why it is advisable that you now begin to organize our emigration as fast as possible. As you can see, this letter will be posted without father's additions. God willing, he will be back soon. Stay well and do not worry too much." Now she follows that up on December 3rd, saying, "Dear Eric, father returned, but with a bad cold. Unfortunately, father had a lung inflammation, and when we took him to the Israelite hospital, the inflammation was healed, but then he had 40 degrees Celsius fever. I visited him Wednesday, and the professor was happy with him and said his condition improved. I went home and was comforted. Now here comes the main thing. Friday, the hospital called to say his condition was critical. We rushed to Frankfurt by car, but unfortunately too late. He died peacefully in his sleep at 5:30. Heart failure suddenly occurred, and thus I, my loving husband, and you, dear Eric, lost the best and most benign father in one stroke."
Thank you for sharing that. When you were reading these letters, that must have, when you first read them, that experience must have been so, I mean, they're moving now.
And Allison, I have to say, setting the music to these words was even another level of intensity. And when I read them now, some of what I read to you is in the actual music. Mm-hmm. Some of it, of course, has to be edited for time, but they really resonate.
And I think we actually have a clip that is in relationship. Am I right, Pilar? Let's take a listen.
"And we will miss him terribly. Please go to a synagogue and say Kodesh.
That's from the jazz opera, Dear Eric. My guests are Ted Rosenthal and New York City Opera General Director Michael Capasso. So Michael, you touched on this earlier, but I want to tease it out a little bit, this idea of jazz opera. Is it common?
No, but it is becoming increasingly more common. City Opera, this will be the 35th world premiere produced by New York City Opera. And as far as I can tell, New York City Opera has produced more world premieres of American opera than any other company. The Metropolitan Opera, if you count Il Trittico as three operas, has produced 34 world premieres, but only a handful of them American. So City Opera has always been at the forefront of new music and of American music and being a champion of American work and American artists. It was important for us to, now that this is an American idiom, Jazz is an American art form. And opera, of course, is an Italian art form that has been adopted by the world at this point. To be able to put the two of them together and present a work that that will speak, it's timeless in terms of its, because it's a story, it takes place during the Holocaust, but it's also a story about a family. And it's a very personal story about a family, which is another reason that I believe that the piece is successful, because you're not just it's not a documentary. It is a story about relationships, relationships that were expressed in letters, and other relationships when we're in the present day that are expressed between living people to each other. And so from City Opera's point of view, it was important to jump on this bandwagon of, you know, if jazz opera is something that's going to be part of the future, then we want to be part of it. We have another world premiere later this season by an English composer named Ian Bell, which is based on Stonewall, and it will coincide with the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. And that's a more traditional opera with a larger orchestra and more traditionally, quote-unquote, operatic, and it is more classical, if you will, although there are sections of it that are written to be played through the jukebox, which mimic 1960s jukebox music, which is something that's very fun. But, the great trumpet player Terence Blanchard wrote an opera called Champion, which has had a great deal of success throughout the United States. And it was an opera about a boxer, but it was written, and he called it an opera in jazz.
Interesting.
And we're calling Dear Erica Jazz Opera.
Yes, we thought about what to call it, and I'm comfortable with that title now. You know, part of the model was loosely was Porgy and Bess.
That's what came to mind when I first heard jazz opera. I thought.
Well, again, for me as a jazz performer, not just composer, mm-hmm. I've played these songs and recorded these songs my whole life since we knew each other way back when. I've been playing these songs, and again, I want people to not only go out humming attractive melodies, but these songs have a life on their own, not just within the context of the opera. So they do stand alone, and I do perform them with my trio, and some other singers have sung them as well as standalone songs.
Was there something that, as you were writing this, were there things that you knew you had to include, and then were there things that you wanted to include, but in the editing process you realized wouldn't necessarily benefit the entire opera once you were finished with it?
Well, we edit, you know, as for the balance, I think, mostly of the story that mm-hmm. we don't, there was a question, whose story is it? Because Eric is the title role, but there are other characters who are quite important. So we edited down certain things to make sure it's still Eric's story. But I really wanted to get to the jazz. So when Eric arrives in Chicago, this is what he's greeted with. He's greeted with the feeling of freedom, democracy, swing.
That's why I wanted to play that clip at the top.
Fun. Yeah. Having fun. Otherwise, people hear Holocaust and, oh boy.
Yeah.
there's that too. But
you don't really think of it as toe tapping.
Yes.
Holocaust. Right.
Exactly. But this contrast, and interestingly enough, I recently came up with this idea, which I think is quite useful in describing it to people, which is, as Michael said, a crossover piece. It's a jazz opera, and it crosses over between the worlds of Europe, European music, and American music jazz. But literally, Eric is crossing the Atlantic, and it's represented not in just the music, but in the actual story that he is crossing over from the European sounds mm-hmm. to the American sounds of freedom, democracy, and swing, namely jazz.
When you finished it and you heard it for the first time, what did you think?
Well, I'm very appreciative to Michael and to everyone at City Opera for giving me this wonderful opportunity to see this come to life, because it has been doubly intense, not only the artistic process, but you layer on top of that this is a family story.
The personal part,
yeah,
yes.
The personal part. So it makes it everything is magnified, and it's just been an amazing process. You know, first there's the music, and then there's the lyric, and then the characters start to come to life, and now they're staging it. So every step of the way brings new excitement.
Michael, what do you hope people walk away from after experiencing this opera?
I hope we create something that will have a future. I think it's important for City Opera to give birth to these kinds of projects. And I hope people will walk away being moved by the story and humming the melody.
And remembering
what it is. And then I hope that that other companies will decide that, you know, it's worthwhile as well. When Ted and I spoke originally, it was my idea to keep it to be a more or less a chamber piece. You know, there's 11 in the orchestra, there's 15 in the cast. It's manageable. It's something that can be produced by other companies without an enormous amount of expense, and so maybe they'll take a chance. And that's what I hope, is I hope it can get out there, and if one of the tunes becomes a standard, that'd be okay too.
The name of the opera, the jazz opera, is Dear Eric. It is premiering at the Museum of Jewish Heritage on January 9th, and it is playing through the 13th. Ted and Michael, thank you so much for being on All of It, and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. WNYC's culture editor Charlie Herman joins us for some weekend picks. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and I am very happy to be catching up with dear friend of the show, Charlie Herman, WNYC's culture editor. Hi, Charlie.
Hello.
It's that time of the week when we try to help you sort out what's happening around town. New York has no shortage of cultural events, so we round down dozens of them, and we come up with the shows, the things that Charlie thinks you need to go see, and also the things that might be closing that have been on your list and you got to get to it. We call it Charlie for the Culture. Hi, Charlie.
Hello. So the first one I have up is called More Forever, and it's at the Guggenheim Museum, and it's this weekend on Sunday. There are two performances and then another one on Monday, and it's by Caleb Teicher and company and Conrad Tau. Now, Teicher and Tau, I'm not really sure that you can say that they are up and coming because they've really seems like they are arriving, but they're both, you know, young men in their early 20s. Teicher, who've been getting a lot of notice, and Teicher is a dancer. Specifically, he's a tap dancer, and he's often commented on because he has this white streak of in his hair. So people often will be like, "Oh, that's the guy with the white streak there." But so he came to New York in about 2011 when he was about 17 years old, and he started dancing with the company Dorrance Dance. Michelle Dorrance.
Oh,
who
yeah, we had her on the show.
Had her on the show. She did a
She's
piece
so
back.
Cool.
Back in the fall with ABT mm-hmm. and won a Guggenheim, a MacArthur fellowship. So he came in, he was there as the company was being formed. And that first year, Dorrance, her company, actually won this very prestigious award called the Bessie Award for Outstanding Production. And while this was his first year, Caleb Teicher's first year, he won Outstanding Individual Performance. Really made a mark early on.
Yeah.
So he has now created his own dance company. It's very focused on tap, but it also is focused on Lindy Hop and swing dancing and what he calls vernacular jazz dancing. And I asked him, what exactly is vernacular jazz dance? And he kind of broke it down. There's, you know, Bob Fosse kind of the jazz style.
Hands.
Well, no, that's more like studio jazz,
okay.
You know, like jazz hands in the studio.
Fosse's more like the
that style.
Crisp,
think Chicago,
this
exactly.
Crisp pop of, yeah.
And then vernacular jazz is more the dance styles of the 30s and 40s, you know, that just have this great name. I mean, there's a lot of great names for dance steps now, but like the Suzy Q and the Charleston and the Shorty George. So these are, I was watching some of the videos the other day. They are great to see them, and you know these steps. So that is Caleb, and then Conrad Tau is a pianist. He's a composer, really a child prodigy. When he was about 10 years old, he was, and this is 2004, he was on the show called On the Top, which highlights young, classically trained musicians. NPR distributes it, and from there he has gone on to win so many different prizes. He recently was the Gilmore Young Artist Award, winner, and that is given only every 2 years to a promising new generation of young pianists. He, just this past fall at the New York Philharmonic, had a world premiere of his latest work by the new music director, Jaap van Zweden. So this is someone who's really out there.
Now, how do these two meet? Are they friends? Was this a put-together collaboration?
They met in a program that brought together young artists, and they've been working together for a while. And what they've done here now, and this is kind of unique, because in the past they have worked with tape music, that they've decided to create a whole program. So Tao has composed the music. It's for piano, electronic, and even toy piano. I mean, literally a little toy piano.
I love that sound. And
they have been developing for the past year. And what it is, it's a particular type of dancing. It's called sand dancing. It is different than tap. You know, tap, normally we have a shoe with the metal that is hitting the wood. These are leather-soled shoes on a wood floor that is covered in sand.
It's cool. I've seen it done.
And when I talked to him, he was saying that they were literally still experimenting with different types of grains of sand to use. Aquarium sand, not so good.
It doesn't give enough swish?
It's a little slippery, I think he said. Ah. So usually it's going to be one dancer in a small box. But in this case, what they're going to do is have this 20-by-20-foot box, and there are 7 dancers. And he said it's really going to allow him to play more with sound, both loud and soft and scraping. So you see a lot of the tap kind of movement, but you'll have just different types of textural sound to play with. This is something that has been in the works for a while. And, you know, Teicher said that he doesn't really think anyone has really explored sand dancing to this level in a long time. Here's a little bit of the music. It's going to sound a little ethereal, but it might give you a sense of what to expect.
Let's do it.
A little bit of a mix of different music there and electronic.
I'm intrigued.
The interesting thing is that this is happening at the Guggenheim, and you might think this is a place where you go to see paintings and sculptures and art shows. For some time now, they've had a program called Works and Process. And actually, this one's a little bit different because it's an actual commission that they asked these two men to put together, this program, and the goal is to go on and perform in other places. In fact, More Forever will be at Jacob's Pillow up in the Berkshires this summer, the big dance festival that happens up there. So normally Works in Process is really a public workshop. It's been around since 1984, and the idea is to try and give the public the ability to see artists as they are developing and pulling projects together. I saw a production of a performance of a show that was going to be at City Ballet, and so the creator was there talking about the show, and then they would do some of the dance, and then they would talk some more about it, and then they would talk to the dancers about it. So they really were trying to, you know, give people the opportunity to see this work being created before it actually premieres. In fact, they do this all the time. You know, coming up, they have Glimmer Glass, the opera festival up in upstate New York, is going to be there with a new work that is being worked on. There's going to be Jerome Robbins Broadway sort of going to be brought back together. So looking at dance, they have some plays that are, you know, sections of them that are being performed. One in particular from Chicago, from Steppenwolf, in conjunction with the National Theater in England. So this just gives an opportunity.
These are all big names.
And it's just really a chance, like, if you're interested in the creative process and hearing people talk and think about it. And they're also looking to get an audience reaction. Like, these are not, you know, set in amber. These are works that are being developed. This one this weekend on Sunday and Monday, a little bit different, but a chance to see some, you know, really, and like I said, I don't want to say up and coming because people have been noticing them, but if you haven't heard about it, it's something to check out.
All right, that's More Forever at the Guggenheim. Something's closing.
Something is closing. You know, when you get into January, you have a lot of art shows that are closing over the next couple of weeks as they get ready for the next one. And one I wanted to point out that is closing this weekend at the Jewish Museum is a show called Chagall, Lazitsky, Malevich, The Russian Avant-Garde in Vitebsk, 1918 to 1922. This is just this moment in modern art history, where these three big names all came together in this small town just outside of, it's now in Belarus. It's a town called Vitebsk. I was looking at it maybe 5 or 6 hours north of Kiev, which is in Ukraine. But what happened here was
love that you went and looked at that.
Well, I looked at it. Long story. But Mark Chagall, this was his hometown. And he, after the revolution, was just so excited about what was coming. And so they created this school called the People's Art School, and it was open and free to the public, and there was instruction and several major figures, El Lazitsky, Kazimir Malevich, these were big names in the world of abstract and modern art. They came and started teaching there, and it was, you know, there were clashes that began to happen, and Chagall, who created the school, eventually left. And a few years later, the first class to graduate was also the last class to graduate as the Soviets kind of cracked down on what was happening. But it was this brief period where you had these artists come together who were really exploring this goal, this idea of a new country with the Soviet Union being created, what they hoped might come. And there's an exhibit of about 160 works. Some of them are quite remarkable. There's a very famous one by Kazimir Malevich, The Mystic Suprematism. It's this red cross on a black circle. You have works from Chagall, which are very figurative. And that's where a lot of the conflict came. One wanted to get into abstraction. One still wanted to do figuration. It's a really interesting window in this period that a lot of people may not know about.
And you have till Sunday to see it.
You have till Sunday to see it.
Charlie Herman, thank you as always.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Have a great weekend, and I hope you have as much fun dancing as AOC did back then. See you next time.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.